Welcome to the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee, and here we have Dr. Kyle Pfaffenbach, forgive me, Kyle, from Eastern Oregon University. We're excited to have you here. We're going to talk about nutrition, particularly what could cause endurance athletes to get an upset stomach. We got a question. It was submitted from, let me just make sure I can see it from here, Byron. Byron says, hey coaches, after watching Kona this weekend, so this is a handful of weeks ago, I'm curious what your thoughts would be on nutrition, especially on what was going on with Blue's gut. Now they're talking about Christian Blumenfeld. I'm going to put up a clip on screen so that you can see right now. If you're eating, don't watch it. It says, Byron says, aside from a gastrointestinal bug, is there anything an athlete could get wrong that would cause so much vomiting? We're going to like approach this from a 360 degree perspective, entertaining all possibilities. And we have Kyle with us here because he's going to kind of go into like what actually could be causing this inside the body and what an athlete could be doing. But if you haven't seen this and you're not watching the podcast, you're just listening to the podcast. This was the Ironman World Championships on the Big Island of Hawaii. They swim 2.4 miles, they bike 112, and they run a marathon thereafter. It's famous for its very varying and but almost always hot conditions, extremely humid when you're close to the water. On a lot of the bike leg, it's extremely dry, usually very windy, and then the run is just like incredibly tough too. So in this race, Christian Blumenfeld was, there was one rider, Sam Laidlow, up the road. Then there was a Magnus Ditlev. And then it was kind of like a pack at this point that we're chasing with maybe one rider off the kind of off the front of that pack trying to chase up. And Christian Blumenfeld, there's only a handful of clips that are online with it. But when I was watching the race, it was probably 10 minutes of not just, you know, verping and a bit of spit up. And I mean, it was full on everything inside you out throwing up while he was on the bike. Absolutely brutal. And he kept pedaling, by the way. I'm not sure he even coasted while he was doing that. He was like kept pedaling for most of it, which is just, and I mean, that's a separate thing entirely. And before we go into this, I do want to cover the fact that Christian Blumenfeld kind of has a track record of throwing up mid-race, typically on the run, though. So I'm thinking to this year, I'm thinking Frankfurt. He did it on the run.
And Germany.
And T100 race, I think I remember him doing it. He certainly did it at Kona before. He's done it at the Olympics. He famously crossed the finish line then just lost it. So this may be a unique to Christian thing. And I kind of want to get into that with you too, Kyle. But this isn't the first time something like this has happened. It's rather a track record of it kind of happening. So Kyle, like, have you had athletes that have dealt with, endurance athletes, who have dealt with vomiting being like a part of their performance experience that they have? Like perhaps with Christian.
I've worked with athletes that have had some like dark times with their stomach and gastrointestinal system during longer races. That was the visual of that is like shocking. How much fluid is
it? Wasn't like, just a little bit.
No. And he's going like, you know, whatever, 27, 28, 30 miles an hour. And it just like, it really does look like someone's like chucking out the side of an Uber on like a drop home. Like, yes. It is so, so that part is shocking. So maybe just like, I didn't see it and people described, oh, I started throwing up and then I just kept throwing up. I have had, I worked with a really high level age grouper one time that had a similar experience at Kona, but like you suggested earlier, it was on the run and it was sort of, it was almost like, this is like where triathletes are different, man. Like they, she was describing it to me and she was saying that it just like got in a rhythm. It was kind of like clockwork. Like she knew that like she'd drink what she needed to drink. She'd get some of it. She'd throw the rest of it up. She knew she could make it to the next aid station. And so I just sort of got in a rhythm of like, I knew where my stomach was and it was like, and then, you know, I have a couple, more anaerobic style 800, 1500 meter athletes that are pukers, that are kind of like, they'll go so hard that they'll puke at practice.
What makes a person a puker? Do you know?
I don't know, to be honest with you. I don't know what the... So it's such a funny question, but it's such a good question. And I've thought about it. I don't know. Like, so there's a couple things that go into play here. One is that intense exercise can cause gastrointestinal distress. And there's a lot of reasons why that can happen. One is like, some people, attribute a lack of blood flow. So there's definitely, so for example, there's some really cool figures in physiology textbooks and online and stuff like that, where you can look at relative blood flow from a percentage standpoint during rest and during exercise, especially during hard exercise. And what happens during hard exercise is that you don't suddenly increase your blood volume, but you have increased demand at your exercising muscles for blood flow. So we have to get that blood to the exercising muscles. And I wouldn't say it's at the expense of other tissues, but there's a reduction in the percentage of blood flow that other tissues see and an increase in the percentage of the available blood volume that a person has to the exercising muscles. And the main mechanism for this is like this really elegant physiologic capability that we have, which is where basically, when you're exercising in your kind of in your fight or flight state, you have epinephrine, norepinephrine, glucagon in the system, like classic catabolic hormones. So epinephrine and norepinephrine are going to globally cause a certain amount of vasoconstriction. So blood vessels are going to constrict and heart rate goes up. And the combination of those two things is like putting your thumb over the end of a hose and turning the hose up higher. So you get increased cardiac output, increased blood pressure. The pump is working harder and faster. Stroke volume goes up. The rate of return is greater in the heart. There's this thing called Frank Starling mechanism. It's super cool, where because the blood is coming back into the heart at a much more rapid pace because of the increased pressure, the heart actually, like when your left ventricle is filling, you get more of a stretch. And the more of a stretch creates this like counter movement, basically, that causes an increased strength and contraction. So like your left ventricle contracts harder when it gets filled to a greater degree under high exercise in order to, so you're, the percentage of the blood, the ejection fraction goes up. So the percentage of the blood that gets ejected with a beat goes up, along with just the volume of the blood that's filling up the left ventricle. So there's all these cool things that are happening to like increase the rate of blood flow going in the system. Now, again, you're increasing pressure through vasoconstriction with epinephrine and norepinephrine, but locally, at the site of exercising muscle, sheer stress from the muscular contractions and high blood pressure and muscular contractions and these types of things, that actually activates enzymes that convert things like like arginine's a precursor for this, or nitrates. But basically what you have this thing called nitric oxide synthase, which is an enzyme that's activated that creates nitric oxide locally. And nitric oxide is a more powerful vasodilator than epinephrine is a vasoconstrictor. So globally, you have vasoconstriction. At the site of exercising muscles, you actually have vasodilation. So it's like you're shunting all this blood to the area that needs it. And locally, when it hits it, it's going top speed. And when it hits it, it just like opens up into this, you know, 12-lane highway that's opened up now. And that's how we get so much blood to and away from exercising muscles. So under these conditions, one of the tissues that is like has compromised blood flow is your gut. And there just isn't as much. And, I think this is an underappreciated aspect of the gut or sort of people just think like, I don't want to put thoughts in anyone's mind, but people may think, I know I at one point had this vision of like you eat food, it goes in your gut, and then it just sort of gets into your, it just sort of gets into your body somehow. But the mechanism of that is blood flow, obviously. And there is a massive amount of vasculature that is connecting your small intestine, particularly into it. It all basically goes into your liver for first pass nutrient uptake. But it's this massive, massive vascular network that requires a lot of blood flow. And so when you're exercising, you don't get as much blood flow to contribute to that GI system. And when you're trying to bring in as much nutrition as people are trying to bring in these days, depending on your ability to absorb that and handle it and those types of things, it can... basically, your absorption can be compromised. And if your absorption is compromised, then things aren't going to get absorbed and they're either going to come back up or they're going to go out the other end. And there are, like you said, Blumenfeld specifically has had a history of this. And it's not always puking. Like puking is the thing that, but in the Munich triathlon, if you go back and look, it was porta potty stops and puking along the way until he kind of got things dialed in and figured that I think he won that race like in the run.
He still had an insane run.
Yeah. So it may be that, you know, he's sticking to his plan and he's getting enough kind of carbohydrates in the system and he's efficient enough, he's fit enough. Because I think that race in Germany was only like 14 days after the Olympics. And he said he hadn't done much long stuff. It's just really interesting. But so maybe people do possess varying abilities to train their gut for different situations. I actually think having a gut that can sort of handle the heat, take on a lot of sugar, take on whole foods like around training and after training. I think that's like something that is actually a talent. Like people, you either have it or it's something that you kind of have to find a way around or you have to work with it or something like that. You don't have to have it to like be a great athlete, for example. You don't have to have an iron gut to be a great athlete, but you do have to have awareness of like what your gut type is, basically.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So I don't know exactly what's going on with him or what makes different people's pukers in different circumstances. There are a multitude of things that can impact gut function. These can be heat is really hard on the gut. So one of the things that the research shows, and I've read several papers suggesting that when you're exercising at high intensity, there's you expose yourself to GI distress, probably for blood flow reasons and some other reasons. But then when you add heat to that, it's like another stress on your gut that complicates things in terms of absorption and just kind of playing nice with your system. One of the more interesting sort of theories about this is that you have so in your gut, there's a single layer of epithelial cells. So the gut is a tube, right? And it has muscle and it has some thickness to it. But the inside lining of the gut wall is a single layer of cells. And those have like those basically have the receptors and things that transporters that get nutrients into the gut, but they're supposed to keep things out of the system that are potentially would be harmful to us if they got into the systemic circulation. Because remember, this is hooked to circulation that goes directly to the liver and then dumps into our bloodstream, the circulatory system. And we'd like to keep our circulatory system separate from like the dirty food and stuff that we're taking down our intestinal tract. And so that single layer of epithelial cells is held together by these things called gap junctions. So they are really just right next to each other. They're not really layered. There is some...
It's like permeable?
Yeah, it's not, they aren't under normal circumstances, but if that gap junction becomes compromised, then they can start letting things in to that, like, we wouldn't normally want to get in. The other thing that's kind of holding things together is that through the lining the layer of the whole gut is this like lathered mucus. So you have this like mucus layer that is covering the epithelial cells. You have the epithelial cells that are filled with the receptors and things like that. They're held together by these gap junctions. And then basically when you get food through, it has to permeate the intestinal wall, go through another receptor on the other side. And then it can get into what's called the portal circulation, which goes to the portal vein, which goes to the liver. And then after the liver sort of filters things and takes a look at what it wants from its nutrient needs, it goes into the systemic circulation. Now, that applies to amino acids, short-chain fatty acids, and glucose. Long-chain fats and a lot of fats are... It's a whole different story. They're absorbed through the lymph system, actually. I mean, they get absorbed through the small intestine, but they enter the lymph system. They get packaged into these like fat balls that are aqueous on the outside and fatty in the middle called chylomicrons. And then those cruise through the system and they get distributed to fat tissue in the liver and they make cholesterol and all these other different types of things.
It's
so
like, it's like we're a Miss Visuals bus right now. Magic school bus. We're going through.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty great. Bus, right? Yeah. Like, and so totally. So there's like a lot going on. It's not just like, oh, we put things in and it's like a strainer. There's active transport, there's passive transport, there's salt balance, there's water, there's co-transport of salt and water and sugar. There is water. So like one of the things that can happen during the heat, during training the heat is a breakdown of that mucus layer. And if that mucus layer starts to break down under like hard stress and the heat, then what happens is those gap junctions become susceptible to letting, and this is the actual definition of a toxin. Like, you know, people say, oh, it's cleaning my toxins, or I sweat out all the toxins.
Yeah.
Like, I won't like get on my horse or my this is the actual, anyone starts just telling you that this does this or that to toxins, could just ask them to explain specifically, define what that toxin is, please. Like, just define it specifically. How did you measure it? How was it? Anyways, so the point is that there are actual toxins on the food that we eat and drink and the air that we breathe, all not breathe, but because it's going to our esophagus. But the whole point is that, like, if an endotoxin that is supposed to be destined for the large intestine and then crapped out or become part of your gut microbiome or whatever it is, if that starts getting into the system, then the system is going to have an inflammatory response and basically say, like, we're done absorbing things. And not only that, but we got to get these things out of the system because it's causing us, like, it's going to cause us harm. And that's when like puking can occur.
Hey everybody, quick break to talk about Trainer Road. And the big question that we want to ask today is your training plan adjusting for you every day? It should. You change every day, and so should your training plan. And if it isn't adapting to you every day, then you aren't training optimally, and suboptimal training looks like getting the wrong workout at the wrong time. And there's nothing more frustrating than that. When you put in all your hard work and all your the effort that you do to go and train, and it's not the right thing that you should be doing. So here's how Trainer Road engineers against that. First things first, we analyze all of your training history. It goes through and looks at what you've done. So then we know the sort of training that works for you. And then it gives that to you. So then you can have a training plan that is designed for you from the ground up. Second from there, it goes through and adapts every day based on what's going on. So this applies to everything that you're doing, not just stuff on the bike. You could do a strength training session. You could go skiing. You could do yoga. You could do any form of cross training, go for a run or a swim. And that now is analyzed by Trainer Road, and it knows how that worked or how hard you worked. So then it knows how to adjust your training plan moving forward. It's incredible. It means that life can happen and you can even add in things additionally by your own will, and your training will still stay on track. In addition to that, you can go through and you can add in all the details on your training calendar of what's going on in your life, illness, vacation, you can add in anything on there and it will adjust. Additional races, you can skip training days or skip training weeks or add in extra. It will always be adjusting for you, doing its best to keep your training on track and keep making you faster. So if you haven't tried it yet, go to trainerroad.com, sign up, try it risk-free for 30 days. Thanks everybody, back to the podcast. So in the case of Christian, it probably makes sense to like run through a handful of things that could have influenced this. Because like you said, it's not like we have like a really clear switch that we can identify that, yes, indeed, this is what causes somebody to experience gut distress to the point of throwing up. Even in his case, like true, like emptying of stomach contents. So I want to go over some things here. First, yes, he does have a track record with it. It does seem to coincide with warm conditions, but I'm not fully certain on that. And then I also want to be clear too, Christian's very like open about this too. He's like talked about this and he's like, yeah, I don't know what happened. He's trying to get to the bottom of it. So this is just us guessing. This isn't us imposing anything upon him. This isn't anything else like that. So some potential causes.
I've never met him. I've never talked to him. We're just going based on what we kind of saw and thinking about
hopefully
this.
Hopefully we can get some good learnings about it.
Yeah. I mean, he's a high profile athlete. So can I just, I'll just say in a context standpoint, this is a lot like trying to figure out cramping. Like there's multiple reasons why cramping can occur. Some people are prone to it. Some people never experience it. There are multiple theories about like the variety of things that can go to cramping. Is it fatigue? Is it electrolyte imbalance? Is it predisposition for it? There's so many different things that can go into it. And so, yeah, we can kind of say these are the things that could be happening to somebody. And you could try and unpack them in sort of a standard way. But the reality is it gets really tough to recreate these conditions because you want to race in these conditions, not necessarily train in these conditions.
That's right. And they had been there for 2 weeks prior and the conditions on the day weren't typical Kona, forgive me, in the sense that it was more overcast than normal. And a bit more, and thusly a bit more humid with less wind on the bike in the first part. So with the course, when you leave town, it's very humid when you're in town. And then you leave town and you go out on the Queen K and it truly starts to feel like you're in like the Nevada desert. It's very dry and nothing is growing. You're just in the lava fields. It's quite dry. And where they were riding through in this case, it was actually overcast and even had a bit of sprinkling going on throughout this. And one observation was made on the broadcast of like, they are absolutely dumping sweat. And perhaps they would be losing that in other conditions too. And maybe we just didn't see it because it would be drier and it would evaporate more. But that observation was made. The conditions were a bit different. It was a bit more humid. It wasn't particularly hot. It was still in the mid 80s and humid. So it's never going to be, it's never going to be cool.
Is probably,
Yeah, super high. But that's one thing to keep in mind is that like the conditions were warm and it does seem to coincide with warm conditions for Christian. But some other potential causes. First off, it was the fastest bike split that's ever been done there. So Sam Laidlow rode 3 hours, 57 minutes and 22 seconds on a 112-mile bike leg. So that's 180 kilometers. That means they did 28.4 miles an hour. Or 45.8 kilometers per hour. It was 7 minutes faster than Sam's own record from the previous year.
With no driving.
And they were,
obviously. Yeah, well,
exactly. Yeah. Sam was solo. And then the rest of the group, we're going to get into the drafting thing. I think that absolutely plays into, that had to have affected them. They're following the rules of no drafting, but that 12-meter rule, they're still absolutely, there is a drafting benefit. Otherwise, they truly would not be riding in a perfect line spaced out with the race ranger telling them when they got too close, right? So there's a reason that they're there. I'm sure that from what it seems like, there's estimates that Laidlow was probably somewhere around like 325 to 330 for power for that time period. And Christian's bigger, I think, in terms of weight. So I would assume that Christian would be putting out more power, but there's the drafting effect. But first things first, that's a really hard effort. Flat out, that's a hard effort. It's making happen
in hot conditions.
Explained to us. Yep. So that's setting the scene for something like this to happen. Now, Christian is known for going very deep. Like, he has a unique ability to put himself in a hole. Like, and this has been, I remember watching a piece and they were talking about Christian before he was Christian Blumenfeld, as we all know him, but he was this athlete that he didn't look like other athletes. He didn't, you know, have like, he didn't have a long track record or some sort of like genetic chain of successful athletes coming down to him, but he would show up to these 10Ks and everything else, and he'd be competing with the best runners in Norway, and he would just be 100% dead. Like, his ability to go deep seems like it is truthfully unique. There's rumors of him having like a 100 VO2 max. I don't know if that's the case. He's a special specimen that can go very deep. Now, another thing, and they hinted at this on the broadcast, he did have a unique and new position on the bike, a Superman style position that caused much sharper hip angle. In other words, like, instead of having from his leg wrapping around his butt and then up to his back, instead of having a more rounded shape, it was just a Z. It was very tight. And then he was more stretched out. That could very well cause, number one, like, he talks about all the musculature and everything else in the vasculature around the gut. It could cause more closing off. It could cause weird contractions he's not used to. And the crazy thing to me is I saw in an interview, and I could have misunderstood this, so correct me if I'm wrong, but basically it was like 2 weeks out, like, he adopted that position, which is just wild to me. That, like, you know, because they have this perspective of being like so precisely measured to the nth degree with he and his team. Yeah. And it seems crazy that like 2 weeks before you'd be like, yeah, I think I'm going to tweak things.
That's
and
better.
I think I'm going to stick with this, you know, like you'd think that that would be a very long process. So that could be a thing.
It used to be though, like, I don't know, with the speed at which they're completing that bike leg now though, it's not the same as like a mortal would take 5 or 6 hours to do that.
A fast mortal. Yeah.
A fast mortal. Yeah. Okay. So, so now you're talking about a change in positioning or something that you have to sustain for 6 hours, not 3 hours.
Yeah, it's a good point.
So maybe
it's less time.
It's like, yeah, you know, it's less time and it went, you know, went great for an hour or went great for a 40K time trial. And then, and it made a big difference in the tunnel. And they were like, yeah, let's just send it. Like, we're going to go for it. And so you bring up a good point with the body positioning is interesting, not just from a, if he was flatter, and I'm out of my comfort zone here talking about like TT positioning and stuff like that. But if he was flatter, there are like mechanical, there's just pure, like, there's gravity and positioning issues with getting food through your digestive tract. There's like a reason why it doesn't feel good to lay down on your back after eating a bunch of food. It's like having that, like, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, maybe it does feel good sometimes, but it's more
there's no feeling good in that case. Yeah.
If you give people the choice, they wouldn't like lay flat on the floor. They'd get in a recliner or something. There's still a little bit of head lift there. And we know that things like acid reflux can be made worse when you lay down. It can be, so there's real, like, there's a real impact of like positioning and those sorts of things. So that's actually isn't something that I thought of prior to having this discussion right now. We're kind of doing this in real time. But if there was just a mechanical change in the positioning of where his gut was and how and it disrupted the normal transit. The other thing is, so the intensity of the exercise, the heat, the volume of what they, so they're probably new, like they're pretty dialed in, like you just said. I mean, everybody at this level is pretty dialed in. And so you're going to know, okay, under these conditions, going this quick with this humidity, what's going to be my sweat rate? And
they've been there for weeks prior too, like two weeks, I think.
And
prior,
so they're going to know.
Likely testing.
Right.
He didn't have his coach with him. That's one thing.
He did not or did?
Did not. His coach was not there with him. I don't know if he's just signed up with a big world tour team. I don't know if it was something with that. Who knows why, but he was not there. So perhaps there was less But I would think that they would have other people assigned to him there.
Yeah, sure. You know,
before you get into the nutrition, there's one other thing I want to cover, because this is definitely a potential thing. It's jellyfish stings. When they got into the water, an absolute, I don't know, do you call it a school of jellyfish? But like they basically just walked directly into a sea of jellyfish. And all the pros and a decent amount of the age groupers got significant stings. Like if you look at Patrick Longo when he crosses the line, kind of looks like he got in a fight. His face is swollen in weird spots. And every pro said that, yeah, like they got into the water and instantly when they got into the water, they're like, whoa, what's going on? Ouch. And they were all getting stung. Now, jellyfish stings do strange things to people. It's different ways. Like
it's different ways. Yeah. It's like a bee sting or whatever. Yeah.
Right.
You're
going to
have a different. Yeah.
So it could very well have caused something.
Response.
Yep. And that could have affected things. But I think that it makes the most sense. So all those things could affect it. We kind of had like the perfect storm for bad things to happen with all the considerations that we've talked about on the external factors.
Plus the jellyfish thing is wild. Like you keep introducing these new things.
Isn't it crazy?
Like, I don't know. Like,
and by the way, he finished this race. He ran, I think it was around 8-minute miles. Who cares? I cannot believe he did not pull out on that bike. He finished, and it's mind-blowing to me that he did that. He's so, there's no quit in that guy.
So, yeah, I mean, that's a whole nother, like, discussion. Like, why, like, if you're one of the favorites and you know you're not going to win, like, I don't know. It's like the argument could be made. You're just like putting yourself in a hole unnecessarily physiologically. Like you, if by continuing on, like it's a totally normal thing for like top marathoners, for example, to drop out when they know it isn't their day. And so the fact that never, you know, it's interesting. I wonder if his coach had been there, if he would have like pulled him off course or told him.
I really don't know.
When you're in the fight, you're not thinking about quitting, clearly. You're not thinking about that, can't be on your mind, or because there's just too many opportunities and too much justification for doing it. The only way people like that are going to quit is if you pull them,
exactly. You have to be the external decision maker for him.
You know? And it's one of those things too. I get frustrated when you see this sometimes when coaches, you know, somebody gets an injury, but they had like a pre-injury and then they get hurt worse. And you hear coaches say, well, he said he wanted to go back in. It's like, that's what you want. You want the staff and the coaches and the crew to like be the decision maker, because that the person, it's part of what makes these people the way they are, is that they're just like never going to quit. I mean, that is amazing.
Yeah.
Running a marathon at like 8-minute pace while you've just puked, like,
and then rode like an almost
who
another
knows
50
how much
miles
volume
after all that.
Well,
puke.
Not only that, but he's puking, and then he's like, you know, he didn't stop drinking and eating, or he would have ended up dehydrated. Like he finished standing up. It wasn't like he. So this is kind of amazing. So I think you're right in terms of the perfect storm, in terms of like he has a history and a predisposition to this. Probably has a certain like comfort level with it that like, I think there's some people that like fight. You know, there's some people that puking like really stresses them out. They don't like it. They'll mentally fight as long as they can not to puke. And there are other people that just go like, yeah, no big deal. I want to puke. I want to get it over with. I know I'll feel better after I get this out.
I think it's to that point. It's
exactly. He has a predisposition for this. He has that. And then you're talking about, all right, so if they had calculated for this much, like sweat rate and sodium loss, but the conditions were different, and then that was altered, and then the hydration was different, and then you combine that with the changes in the gut and the new position and the sheer like effort, the effort, like I don't know how much faster these guys can get. Like it's
amazing. It's astounding.
It's amazing. Like 3 hours for 112 miles solo in like 85 degree heat across these like lava. I know what you're talking. I mean,
yeah.
Like if people haven't, just look up like the lava field bike leg of Kona or whatever. I mean, it's like being on Mars and you're just like hammering. And then he also pushes it in terms of, I know he's up around 120, 140 grams of carbs.
And this brings up an interesting point to cover. So we talked about the fact that kind of like comparatively a somewhat surprising close proximity position change on the bike. Mm-hmm. And within the 2 weeks leading up to the race, Magnus Ditlev he's a competitor, Magnus Ditlev too, Christian Blumenfeld. Yep. And I think he was asked how many carbs. Yeah, an amazing ride and run and everything. He was asked how many carbs he was going to, or what his nutrition plan was, and he said he was going to take in 180 grams of carbs per hour on the bike. Now, he's an absolute unit. Like, he's really tall, really, and he's rumored to have a huge FTP. We've talked about this before. But that's what he was saying. And part of me wonders, like, you know, if he was so willing to, or if he was ready and willing to make a position change so close, maybe there was a decision to be like, hey, like, if he's gonna do 180, I wanna try to do 180. I think that's probably the least likely with such a measured crew. But here's the other thing, Kyle. This is, I know that he's sponsored by Marten. Now, it could be, he could be using other products, right? Like, we know that sometimes people don't. But the one thing to keep in mind with Marten products is that sodium, they are not stocked up with sodium like you find in most other modern high carb intake products. Look at like Precision Fuel and Hydration, Never Second, like the other ones that are designed for like high carb intake. They're typically per 90 grams, you're going to be getting like a minimum of like 600, 800 milligrams of sodium in there. Whereas with Marten, you're not getting that. So as a result, like if you drop your nutrition, which totally happens in transition or getting on your bike, let's say that, you know, if you have to decouple sodium from your carbohydrate intake, you suddenly have a vulnerability in your program because you can't, when you're taking something in, you could say it on the other side too, that if you need to decouple them, you can't. But in triathlon in particular, it's very common. I'm sure triathletes, you can back me up here. You drop a gel, or in this case, salt capsules, or some solution that you were going to drink, or you weren't able to drink it for one reason or another. And then if all you're left with is something that's just sugar, taking in water, could that also mess up the gut if you're, if you don't have enough sodium?
Yeah, so this was one of the other, so if you talk about like the structure, so we talked about the like structural thing, like with the mucus and the, and then you talk about the blood flow and you talk about the impact of heat and high intensity. And then the way he was puking, you read about or see people suffering from like hyponatremia that are, so this is the point you're bringing up. So that if you're not bringing in enough sodium with the fluid that you're bringing in, and you're bringing in too much fluid and not enough sodium, the basically the ratio of fluid to sodium gets off. And it's called hyponatremia. It's too low of sodium in the extracellular space. It's pretty rare. Like, you typically only see it under examples of people chugging like massive amounts of plain water and not having any sort of salt capsules or salt intake or salt in their food or those sorts of things. You could, I guess, be a little more susceptible to it if you were a salty sweater. The ability of him to override normal signals regarding fatigue can also put you into like these circumstances where it's kind of like you've trained your brain to like go beyond these signals that would tell other people to kind of, hey, I should just make sure I get off and get this fluid. And yeah, it might cost me a little bit of time, but I'm going to do this. Like, if they're so in that mode, but yeah, if you're taking in fluid under those circumstances, then basically what your body is trying to do is eject that fluid because it's trying to like clamp on and hold on to the sole and get fluid out of the system. And so it basically rejects that. And you see reports of that. I know hyponatremia it happens sometimes with like early season football players in like
super
take
hot
a look
conditions.
At a, yeah, really hot conditions. They're doing these really hard. They start cramping. They start puking. And then there is sometimes the recommendation is like, go drink water until your cramps go away, or go drink. But it's like, that's the opposite of if you're not understanding the role of salt in these conditions, stuff like that, and someone has susceptibility to it. The other time I've heard of it, I actually had a friend who was a rafting guide that was like, he was describing another guide or a client or something like that that was hungover, woke up the next day, they're rafting the river, they're in the sun all day, he was nauseous, and he was just pounding like Nalgene bottle after Nalgene bottle, thinking that that was going to like make him feel better, thinking he was just dehydrated. But really but there's usually under those circumstances, there's often like some central, if it's true, like hyponatremia, there's usually some central nervous, like people get combative, they lose their coordination, they get,
yeah,
like there's some
things
changes.
Are going haywire in the body.
Yeah. You're unlikely to run 26.2 miles under those conditions. And which is what this person executed. And so it seems more of a combination of sort of like probably the day, the stress hormones, the propensity for this, the willingness to get past it, the ability to take on, to continue to take on water it with fluid and carbohydrates, get enough of it to fuel 8-minute miles, although I'm assuming he was like using a lot of fat. Like he's probably the majority of the energy he can use at 8-minute mile pace is fat. So, yeah. And that's why it's limited his like really hard ability. It'd be interesting to have his, I know we're kind of doing a case study and we don't even know the guy and have to talk to him, but we're just like breaking it down.
Come on, Blue. Let's talk about it. Yeah, it'd be great.
Yeah, it'd be really interesting to look at what his heart rate data was before and after the puking episodes, and then what adjustments to his heart rate were made during running. Like if it was still that's if the relative heart rate went up and that's all he had, or if like the limitations from a fuel standpoint weren't allowing him to like give his normal level of effort. So I think
sometimes that happens, like athletes will feel this where when you, and it might even be after a situation like this where maybe you are puking and going through that or not, but sometimes you'll have situations where you just, it's not like your heart rate's super high, even your RPE isn't crazy high, but you're just capped. And it's just like,
you just can't work more,
and you know, it's a really odd feeling. It's an odd feeling
because you're like, I feel like I could do this. And then you just pick it up, whatever, 5 seconds per mile faster. And you're like, okay, I'm going to squeeze down a little bit. And the body, it'll just push back and go like, no, can't do that. And you kind of go back into more of this thing that you can sustain. It's super frustrating because in some ways it prevents you from like getting to the dark place that a lot of us look for when we're trying to test ourselves with these types of efforts. And so it'd be interesting to find out, like, if this, you know, we think it's amazing that he was puking like that on the bike and then he finished the run, but the run could have just been like, you know, 3 hours of zone two for him. And it's
just a stroll,
like,
I'm sure.
Yeah.
You know, very uncomfortable, point, like, I bet.
it potentially, but I mean, if he's keeping fluids down at that point, and that's the thing is like, I don't know if the cameras got away from him or if we have any reports about whether he was puking on the run, but if he wasn't puking on the run, it means he backed off the intensity enough to where his body was allowing him to absorb nutrients at that point. And so,
yeah. From what I've heard, that it wasn't like a continual thing on the run, but I could be totally wrong. I'd be really interested to know if I am wrong. So let me know down below. But what I'm grasping here, Kyle, is that like if athletes do have scenarios like this, or if an athlete is fearing a scenario like this, here are some takeaways that I want to run by you, and you can vet them for
sure.
Me. So
and I have a couple just small things I'm probably going to add, but go ahead.
Cool. Perfect. So number one, if you know that you're going to be in hot conditions, that sort of thing, it's likely good to replicate those conditions as close as you can beforehand. Indoor training is a fantastic way to do that. And then what you can do is just kind of understand how your body reacts. Just take in your normal nutrition plan and see what happens with your body. That's probably a good thing to do before an event like this. We also talked about fact that if you really are, chances are, if you're doing a race that's, you know, if you're doing like road racing, that's, you know, something that's going to be 2 to 3 hours and nothing longer than that, it's going to be extremely hard, extremely intense. If you're doing something longer than this, it shouldn't be extremely hard and extremely intense in terms of the actual effort that you're putting out. So if you're doing these long ones, it's probably not going to be just the all-out effort. The fact that Blumenfeld and these athletes can ride at such a high amount of their threshold, like for so long, is a weird thing that probably doesn't apply to even most of us that are listening to this that will be considered fast cyclists. So it's probably less the effort, more the environmental conditions that you have coming in. Mm-hmm. And it's extremely important to be aware of your sodium, fluid, and carbohydrate needs and making sure that you're fueling those. That kind of seems like the best approach for probably the people listening to this to avoid situations like
yes.
this.
So there's a couple other things I would add to that. I generally agree with all of those statements. One, it would be to, you do want to try and get some intensity in hotter conditions and see how the nutrition goes down. Like you kind of want to find out what the limit is and what you push and those types of things. And so like we're getting reports now of people going from 60 grams of carbohydrates per hour to 180 grams of carbohydrates per hour. And this is going to be like highly, highly individual. And so what I would say is that for people, you really want to be focused on two things. One, what can my body handle at this time right now under these conditions? Two, what is it capable of responding to and getting to, basically? So don't get super frustrated if you are like, all right, I'm going up to 140 and it doesn't work out. You got to go in like a stepwise fashion. And you guys have talked about this, no mm-hmm. pun intended, ad nauseam, for under these things, but you can build, and at some point you're going to reach a ceiling and just be like, I can't get any more benefit out of this. If someone can truly get 180 grams of carbohydrates, and my question under those circumstances is how much is ending up in the colon and how much is actually getting extracted? That would be the question, right? Like the, and then you're starting to look at like genetic polymorphisms around glucose receptors and overexpression of these things versus regular expression of these things as like part of your talent identification process and those sorts of things. So we'll go like, that's where this is going in terms of if we're finding people that can do this. But in general, you're doing really well if you can get 100 grams of carbohydrates in an hour. Mm-hmm. And in like along with your sodium and along with fluid to prevent like more than 3 or 4% body fluid loss. There are some things though that you can do. So glutamine, for example, is an isolated amino acid. It's not a branched chain amino acid. There's some really interesting studies that show that high dose glutamine can actually fortify that mucus layer. There are examples of taking glutamine and exercising under hot conditions at high intensity and this helping a little bit. There are less examples under ultra conditions. So for example, several of the ultra athletes that I've worked with, we've tried different amounts, different combinations, different frequencies. But again, it becomes so difficult at these ultra distances to recreate the race conditions. And you get a lot of people reporting from age groupers all the way up to pros reporting, this goes great in training. And every time I get in a race, this or that happens. And there's some other special sauce that's going on during that race condition, whether it's sleep deprivation, whether it's the length, whether it's the intensity, whether it's just the kill mode that's engaged mentally under those conditions. So I don't know if we're going to like figure that out, because it's just a really difficult thing to study in like a really good way. But the glutamine thing is kind of interesting. You can go look at it. Gastroenterologists look at it. It's a way
you can just
to
buy that. I'm looking now. You can just buy it on Amazon.
Oh, yeah.
And
like $12 for a huge.
So supplementing with that can potentially help rebuild or reinforce that mucus.
I would
layer.
Say the reinforce part, not the it's not sort rebuild. Of like it can maybe delay the breakdown in that mucus layer that could be one of the causes of an upset stomach, GI distress under these circumstances.
Is it a co-ingestion sort of thing where you want to take it with other stuff, or can you just add
no,
it to like
the the protocol, but again, they're for shorter efforts. I think the protocols were like a couple hours before. So it's basically like with your pre-race meal, you're trying like fortify that. And I'm also
if you're training consistently, would you take it like habitually, just like you would take creatine or something else?
It would depend on how often this thing is happening and who is more or less susceptible to it. And you would absolutely want to try it in training before racing. And then if you find that it works, I mean, glutamine is just an isolated amino acid. It's not like there's no, if your stomach can handle it and it reduces the amount of GI distress you have, especially in hot conditions, then yeah, I would use it as a tool. Because like, again, you don't want to like hold back. There's no reason to hold back magic food for race days. The thing that makes you fast on race day is consistent training. And the consistency at which a person is capable of training is dictated on the amount of stress and stimulus they can apply to the system and fully recover and adapt to it. And so if you can increase that training stimulus under adverse conditions, it's probably going to make you more comfortable on race day. So it's not one of those things that you want to like reserve. So that one's really interesting. And then there's a lot out there about the gut microbiota and the resistance to GI distress, especially when you're consuming different types of food. So now,
in terms of a protocol for reinforcing that? There's a billion different things.
Just two, like but, literally.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
I mean, because they do it in billions. It's like they categorize it by billions.
What do you recommend?
To be honest with you, I'm hesitating because of how convoluted that whole our understanding of that field is at this point. There's just so many. So we know that really good endurance athletes' gut microbiomes are different than people that are recreationally active athletes and sedentary athletes. What we don't know is if training as an elite athlete alters the gut microbiome, or having a particular gut microbiome makes you more likely to be exactly. And so there's some examples of where you can really alter your like colony, like the population of your colony, the number of strains that are in your colony, all these different types of things. There's also like some sort of genetic component to it. There's also a whole bunch of other factors regarding like diet, environment, all these different types of things. So in my brain, it's like still, we know that it's important. We know that you want to be doing something towards it. It's really hard to just make a general recommendation because how many individual iterations. What I can say is that there's a few things that you can think about. The first is you want if you were going to start with something, you would want a broader variety of strains. Okay. So what happens is a lot of probiotics that you can buy that are commercially available, if you look at them, it's actually only like maybe two strains. Like there'll be a bifidobacterium and a lactobacillus, or there'll be an acidophilus. And you'll see these, and these names, they're not meant to like mean a lot to you. They're just all these different strains of bacteria. And some of them have been related to specific stomach ailments, things like reflux, for example. This will help with reflux. This will help with traveler's diarrhea. I know one of them like posits that. These will help with. Then there's other ones that you can get. So like Garden of Life has one. There is a Now Makes Several. And those are good companies that they grow their own cultures. They do their own, all these different types of things. And you can get like 10 strain ones, or the Garden of Life has like a 15 strain one. And so that's probably like a little bit of a play. I don't know if we can like say actual brands on it.
Totally.
But yeah.
We aren't so sponsored by anybody.
So those are places that I would say are a more reasonable place to start. One, because they typically have more bacteria in them. You want somewhere between 50 and 100, even up to 200 billion, what are called CFU. That's how they're kind of measured. A lot of people will tell you, well, I eat yogurt. I mean, there's maybe like 500 million in yogurt or whatever. Even though you need, and then the same with, if you look at kombucha, people say, well, I drink kombucha, and it'll be like one or two strains and maybe 500 or 1 billion or 2 billion. It's just, we have, again, I'm not providing medical advice. I get real nervous, like kind of making these types of statements, but I'm confident in saying for a lot of people and that adding some sort of probiotic at a level that is more 10, 20, 30, 50, even 100 billion is probably at least a place to kind of start. There's a company called LiveCap that is based off of a pretty well-studied, patented combination of 8 bacteria. Huh. It's sold in Europe, I think, under the name SIVOMIX, and it's sold in the United States under the name LiveCap. And the founder of that company has actually gotten that certified in Form Choice and NSF for sport.
Oh, sweet.
Awesome. And they have some really, interesting data that suggest that they actually have some molecular mechanisms worked out where they suggest that it can actually reduce the amount of oxygen that's required by your gut during exercise. Wow. It basically promotes anaerobic metabolism. And so your gut becomes like, your gut is still functioning and has the energy that it needs, but it's functioning anaerobically, which then leaves more oxygen for other tissues that need it more. So they're doing different types of studies in a variety of different types of athletes, and they're trying to reach athletes. It's quite expensive.
Very expensive.
Yeah. So there's a couple places to start. With that though, there was a European study that was done. It's a small sample size, I think about 60 patients that had, we'll have to look this up. Maybe we can talk about it next time, but this is just, it's in the public record. It's published, but there was an Italian doctor that had, several, COVID patients that were hospitalized that, he basically administered, I think it was around 800 billion of SIVOMIX, or SLAB 51 is what it's called. So 800 billion 3 times a day or 4 times a day to these patients, and none of them ended up needing to be intubated. And now it's a small sample size. It was not like double blinded.
Sure.
It wasn't.
Sure.
But it was it's a really interesting paper. You should go find that paper. It's
cool.
I can email it to you. So
that'd be great.
So yeah, I do. So those are the two main things that I would add, is like a probiotic and glutamine. And don't get frustrated when you start looking for the right probiotic, because there's so many out there. Just companies like Now, for example, they grow their own cultures, they package it, so you know it's there. LiveCap, again, it's super expensive, but it's high quality. And then Garden of Life, those are kind of the three. You'll see a bunch of others, but you really want to make sure. And if you try it for a week or 2 weeks and you don't see any difference, either up the amount or try something different with different strains in it. So
cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is super helpful, Kyle. Thank you. Practically speaking, we are able to give some practical advice to people. And it's just fascinating. And I want to give respect to Christian Blumenfeld for finishing that race.
So impressive.
I think it's and I don't want to glorify suffering in vain and damaging oneself, but I think that he showed an immense amount of respect for the event and for his relationship that, like, there's a mutual understanding there that at the world championship event of such fame as Kona, that when he's there, somebody who absolutely can win and was the favorite to win, that he still did. I hope it didn't come at any true harm to him, but that was a respectful thing for him to do, I think, in that regard. So super fascinating. We will have links down below to some probiotics. They aren't sponsored.
Sure.
It's just if they help you, we'll put them down there. We'll also have links to any studies or anything else that we referenced in here. We'll have them down below. You can check it out. And if you're listening to this and you want to get faster, you need to sign up for Trainer Road. It's AI cycling coaching. It gives you the workouts you need to get faster. Go do it. Cool. It's the time of year to do it. The new training plan builder is incredible. People are absolutely loving it. And there's more exciting updates coming soon. So go sign up now, trainerroad.com. Talk to you all next week.
All right, cool. See you.